Welcome to Take the Red Pill,
where we explore the realities within our reality.
We are your hosts, David Deere
and Donald Dalton.
This week, we are going to talk about love. Our topic today is love. So Donald, why don't you tell us a little bit about your thoughts on love?
Well, you know, love is one of those things that everybody wants. Everybody enjoys when they have it. When you say the word love, people know what you're talking about. There are so many ways that love expresses itself. You know, they say that there's two forces in the universe. There's love and fear, and everything comes from those two emotions. And so, you know, love, you know, you have a love of a parent for a child, a love of pet owner to their pet. Then you have a love of family members. You have a love of romantic interests. You have a love of friends. You have a love of technology. Love is expressed in so many different ways that to actually condense it down to one specific definition, I think it becomes very difficult because love is. So do you, a definition that might work better for just, you know, flat out love?
Well, it's really hard to define, but you know, I was thinking about what you said about there's two ideas, only love and fear.
Oh yeah. Two energies in the universe,
love and fear. I kind of had that thought when you said that. I wonder if there really is two different ideas, if there is love and fear.
Oh.
I mean, if you think about this, doesn't fear stem from love?
Fear would stem from the absence of love, just like love would stem from the absence of fear.
I don't think love stems from the absence of fear.
Hmm.
But I do think that fear stems from the absence of love. But to have a fear, people fear losing something that's of value to them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Something that they love. You know, maybe in a minute we could talk about what that really means, what love really means. But when you have a fear, if you're not afraid of losing something, if you're not afraid of encountering something, I mean, well, people could say that, you know, you have a fear of pain, and that doesn't mean that it's a love of not being in pain. Yeah, maybe.
Depending on who
you may are. Have to slide back a little bit on that. But
some people enjoy the pain.
Yeah, well, there is that too. I love the pain. But then they're not afraid of it, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. There are some people that love fear, which is kind of a weird thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I mean, what do you think? Am I stretching it a little too much?
I find it interesting that you present a double standard for both fear and love, where fear is the absence of love, but love is not the absence of fear. I'm still trying to wrap my head around that because, you know, if you can picture a symbol of a yin-yang, you know, where everything is in balance, you have a light side and you have a dark side, you know, that's more of how I see things, where if you're not in love, then you're in fear, and if you're not in fear, then you're in love. Taking that to a more precise example, as opposed to just saying, well, everybody has fear, so we must not be in love. And like, no. You know, there's different areas of our life and different experiences and different opportunities that we have that create fear and or love. You know, if you're going for a job interview, you might have a little bit of anxiety, a little bit of, you know, fear because you want to have the job and you don't want to have the feeling of being unsuccessful, of having failure. Mm-hmm. If you get the job, then you'll be excited and happy and you'll love that feeling. That brings up an interesting point. Can we actually love, or do we just love the emotional states that we are able to have?
I guess we have to talk about what that means to love. Because you said, can we have love, or do we just love the emotional states that we can have? Is that right?
Yeah. Do we love being happy, or do we love going out and partying, or do we love watching our favorite TV show, or do we just love the feeling that these things, the emotions and the, you know, excitement that these come with us, that those allow us to feel?
Well, here you go. You've sent me an invitation in gold pen to wax esoteric, and I'm going to take it and run with it.
Go,
you know how I like to do that, right?
Yes, go for it.
All right. Fasten your seatbelts. There'll be no smoking. Now.
Will there be drinks be served?
Yes. The flight attendant will be coming by to get your drink orders. If we're talking about love, what love is, to me, love is a resonance. Love is a connecting with a resonance of, when you said love is, mm-hmm. that is the most cryptic and yet most concise way that you can actually put it. Love is. Mm-hmm. It's like, I am that I am. It's that kind of idea. And I think that love is a recognition of the divinity of one's self, the purely divine essence that we all have and that we all are. And that is love when we truly connect and recognize that. So your question is, do we actually love these things, like eating a juicy hamburger or a television show or hanging out with friends? Or do we love the feeling that that gives us? Because we are so interconnected to all these things, and because the feeling gives us, we incorporate that feeling into who we are. Mm-hmm. We truly do connect with the things that give us those good feelings. We become those good feelings in a sense. So I would say that the answer is, you know, check the D, all of the above.
Okay. This brings up another really kind of science fiction idea out here. For artificial intelligence, will they ever be able to love, or will they just learn how to love by example from their programming and what they observe?
Artificial intelligence is a weird thing, because we have to talk about, you know, then again, what is life and what is the definition of what being alive is. And then that also goes into the whole idea of self-awareness. And then we have to ask if animals even feel love, you know. I always look at my dog licking my wife's face and I'm like, oh, you know, she loves her. But I mean, is that an anthropomorphic idea?
Yeah, I was about to say, I don't think you can talk to any pet owner and say that loved animals do not feel love in any way, shape, or form. It's like, no.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I believe they do. I mean, to me, it's evident. We don't doubt it, you know. Mm-hmm. We can feel it. And that's the thing about love is love, it's one of those things that you can just feel. You know it when you feel it. Mm-hmm. Because I think it's that rush of feeling alive. I've never known anyone to say, I feel love, but it's a really dead feeling. It's a non-feeling. I you know, so that's why I say that love is so interconnected to our sense of being alive. It's the sense of who we are. Our isness.
So, since there are so many ways to feel love, is it possible to live your life feeling love and not feeling much fear, if any, at all?
That's a tough one, because, you know, we talked about that whole idea of fear in the fear episode.
Yeah, it was scary too.
I was actually afraid of doing that episode before we started. I'm afeard. But in that episode, we talked about fear being, you know, a distortion from a biological impulse, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we have the animal, you know, mountain lions walk in, then we all of a sudden go into automatic. You know, it becomes distorted when we start being afraid of something that hasn't happened yet, or we have fears created from a past event, even though it's not a clear and present danger. Tying that to love, can we experience the life of love without fear? Well, you know what? I would say that we would experience a lot more love without fear. Yeah.
That's what I'm saying is, you know, if you're here in a, you know, physical body, then you're going to experience fear one way or another at some point in your life. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying, is it possible to not experience fear and live completely out of love, or taking the other side of the coin, live completely out of fear and never experience love?
I think you can live completely out of fear and never experience love. I do believe so. And I believe that the people who do so are usually people who can commit acts of atrocity. Mm-hmm. You know, we talked about the good and evil in the good and evil episode. I think the people that we would categorize as evil, these are people that, well, okay, let me stop there, because this is tricky, because, like, I watched an interview with Dennis Rader, mm-hmm. the BTK killer.
Oh, okay.
This is a man that we say is evil. People like to say, well, BTK, you know, Dennis Rader was evil. And I truly believe in my heart of hearts, when I watched the interview with him and he talked about being in prison for the rest of his life, and the thing that was the worst part about life sentence to him is that he was no longer connected to his son. He no longer had contact with his son or his children. I don't remember which it was. But his children, it pained him greatly to be without his children.
Hmm.
So that's to say he loved his children, right? I mean, there are people who would argue with me, say that man doesn't know love. A man that's capable of those acts don't know love. But to me, that says, you know, we take the act of killing someone, watering it down to something so much more benign, like, you know, saying something mean to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
That's not killing somebody, but yet it is an act that is hurtful to another person, right?
Oh, yeah, it's like physically punching them, except you're doing it mentally and emotionally.
Right, exactly. If you're fighting with someone, not like in a boxing ring, but if you're physically fighting with someone because you're angry, you're punching someone, fueled by emotion, that is wanting to cause them harm. Are you incapable of love?
But see, that's where we get into more of distilling down the emotions that come with fear. That would be out of anger and rage, which would be on the side of fear, as opposed to, you know, being on the side of love. You would have to logically say that, yeah, that would be a lighter form of, you know, attacking somebody or killing somebody. And one's just more to the extreme than the other one, but all of them are the same thing. And I think that's probably why the people that are the most considered the most holiest of the whole, like the Dalai Lama and Mother Teresa, Mahatma Gandhi, they were all about, we can do things peacefully. We don't have to fight to make our point. You know, somebody hits us, we'll show them compassion back. And I think that's coming from the same point of, well, I'm not going to switch from a place of love to a place of fear just so I can match wherever influence I'm getting at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
For me personally, I don't know if anyone could actually live a full physical life and not feel fear. I think there's just too much experience that you're meant to have. And how can you grow if you never experience anything of fear? Like, how do you overcome fear and become stronger and overcome, you know, anxieties about things without, you know, facing them? What? Why would you incarnate? You know, going back to our past lives episode, what would be the reason to have past lives or reincarnate or be on the wheel of karma?
Well, I do think that the Ascended Masters would be the exception to that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one thing we didn't talk about last week. And we won't go into it too much here.
We mentioned
the
it.
Last episode, the Ascended Masters. Yeah, the Ascended Masters, I do believe, are incarnated without that sense of fear, because they don't have that. I mean, they're so connected to the divinity of love and what love is on a very divine scale that they are without fear.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree completely with you that we do come into this life with fears because we're learning how to reconnect with our own divinity and our own lessons of who we are and what we are in this great universe. And I think when we are disconnected from who our own divinity, that's when we truly start to experience fear. And I want to use the example that we're talking about, the pugilist.
Okay.
the guy who wanted to you know, beat the other guy down.
Mm-hmm.
I think whenever we have anger towards another person, that is because that person, we're angry almost, you know, I would say almost 100% of the time. There's no such thing. Let's say 99% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
that's almost exactly like my car, except that it has bigger wheels and, you know, it's red and it's a Toyota instead of a Ford. Okay. All right, I had fun there. The difference.
I think it'd be a Chevy and a Ford, because there's a whole thing between Chevy owners and Ford owners.
Yeah, there is that kind of weird war, isn't there?
Yeah.
The bow tie guys and then the Ford, the blue oval guys. It's like a scene out of West Side Story, you know. When you're a Ford, you're a Ford.
And when you're a Chevy, you're a Chevy. But what would be the love story in that? I don't know.
Yeah, I know. Love like a three big block, whatever the 320. But
that's for all the people who want a little culture in your podcast.
Well, the thing is that we just divided camps because the guys who are really into cars are probably not into West Side Story and vice versa. So, but here we are. So in any event, the whole idea of anger,
uh-huh.
I think a lot of times anger stems from when we are angry with another person because they do not recognize our value. They failed. Like, for example, somebody cuts you off on the road. You know, they didn't consider your safety. They didn't consider you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's when we become angry. And we are angry. Why that's a big deal to us is because when we feel we need that validation from someone else, when we do not have enough self-love and we have created an expectation for someone to treat us a certain way, it's this kind of warped validation. That's my theory as to where anger stems from. Anger, I believe, stems from a lack of self-love.
Mm. Like what you said, a perception of not being treated the way that we feel we should be treated. Like, I'm going to take your example of being cut off in traffic. I believe most people, if not all, would be a little upset if, you know, when you get cut off in traffic. And if you've driven for, you know, almost any length of time, you've probably been cut off at least once.
Mm-hmm.
My dad, I love him, but he has a very narrow view of what causes people to do certain things. And it's very funny because anytime, you know, he'll be watching the news or something, or he'll hear about something, some big accident, or, you know, somebody got in a car wreck, or be driving down the road and, you know, there's, you know, somebody got in a fender bender. His first reaction is always, oh, they're probably drunk.
Mm.
It's like, there's a number of other possibilities that could be happening other than them being drunk.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of interesting with the whole cutting people off, and I'll admit that this has happened to me too. I have cut people off and not realized that I did it until right after, because mm-hmm. I just wasn't paying enough attention on the road. And in that example, I'm not trying to treat somebody differently or be mean or anything. I'm just being a little airhead.
Exactly. Yeah.
And the other person,
90% of the cases, I would say.
Yeah. And so the other person's perception is, you know, they can take it as, you know, I'm being mean and I'm just being, you know, not caring or anything. Or they could be like, oh, dude's having issues.
Well, but that's the thing is most people, or let me not say most people, but a lot of people in a lot of the scenarios don't say dude's having issues. Most of the time people do that, their mind is somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And I would say that a lot of the accident issues that we say and a lot of the traffic issues that we see are people just being careless. They're just not thinking about what they're doing with driving. What happens is you've got the guy behind saying, hey, you're not thinking about me. I'm mad because you're not thinking about me. So in other words, that person's not thinking about them. They're not thinking maybe this person had a really bad day. Maybe this person's wife just filed for divorce on him. And, you know, but yet that's not my problem, buddy. You know, it's what I'm saying. It's kind of ironic. They're mad because the infraction driver didn't think about this guy, but this guy's not thinking about the infraction driver.
Uh-huh. We're not talking about Fred McMurdleberry again, are we?
McMulderberry?
McMulderberry. I can never remember if it's McMurdleberry or McMulderberry.
I just listened to that episode last week, and it's Fred McMulderberry.
Mulderberry. Like, yeah. X-Files and then
like the X-Files. That's how I know, yeah. McMulderberry.
Yeah. Well, staying on the whole traffic theme, I have noticed numerous times, especially much more in the past couple years, that people are being more and more open to, you know, letting people in line, you know, merge or whatever. Like, okay, you're at a stoplight and traffic is moving nicely or, you know, slowly, and someone is coming out of a parking lot and they want to get in. And, you know, it's kind of like I'm starting to notice more and more people being like, oh, yeah, go ahead. Sure. No, no big whoop.
You might want to remind our listeners that we're in Washington State.
Oh.
You're not going to see that in New York or Boston.
Or Jersey.
Or Jersey, right. It's just you can't drive that way. It's just it doesn't work. But no, you're right. There is something about maybe it is just here in Washington. Hopefully people in other parts of the country are seeing it.
Uh-huh.
But you're right. I mean, there is a kind of a sense of kindness. And I don't know if you've noticed that when you're feeling good and when you're really balanced and you're on the road and somebody does an infraction against you on the road, it might startle you, and that's just adrenaline. Mm-hmm. But you don't go, you beep, this beep, beep, beep.
Oh, I'll tell you what. When I used to be a delivery driver years ago, it would freak me out how people would, you know, get tailgate so close, and I would be like, "Get off my ass, damn it!" And I just get so angry about them because I'm like, if I have to stop, you're rear-ending me.
Right.
And now, for the past couple of years, I realized, why am I putting so much energy, so much negative energy into somebody who just wants me to go faster?
Right.
You know, I don't have to go faster. It's so basically all I need to do is like, well, you know, if it's their choice to follow that closely, they have that much faith in their brakes and their reaction time to follow that closely if something happens. And insurance will be in my favor because they would rear-end me.
Right, exactly.
Looking at it from that point, you know, it's just like, I'm going to drive as the way I feel is safe, and if you don't like it, then you can wait till the road turns to a two-lane road or go a different way. And if it makes you upset, I'm sorry.
Well, you know what you've done there, Donald, is you've allowed them to be what they're going to be.
Exactly.
And what, instead of owning the pressure that they were giving you, you know, you're owning it by getting upset with them. That's kind of the funny thing about that. But when you're in a good place and you're saying, you know what, I'm well within my right to do whatever I need to do, this is how I'm going to live. And then when someone questions the choice you're making, which is to be driving at the speed limit, oddly enough, you have enough comfort to be able to say, you know what, it's okay that they feel this way. However, I think what I'm going to do is pull over into that little middle left turn lane, let them pass me. And you know, there's a lot of people that would say, you know, no retribution for you. I'm actually going to slow down to 5 miles an hour, and that'll show you, which it never does. This is my but, and this is the disconnect between people, and this is where love falls into a big pit.
Mm-hmm.
Like the guy, I know driving, to me, driving is a great example for kind of emotional weight of things.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
And
how disconnected we get. We get kind of around this big armored steel box, and we become insulated and segregated from everybody else that we're sharing a road with, you know.
And the bigger the vehicle, the more insulated and disconnected we feel.
At times, yeah. Vehicles are so synonymous and symbolic of control.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to control this vehicle. And when your control is compromised, you feel like your own sense of power has been compromised. But if you have that kind of groundedness and that self-love, that is not easily compromised because you know that nothing is really being slighted against you, you know?
Oh, yeah. When I started looking at when I was driving, and this is after I had been a delivery driver, and, you know, started seeing things from that perspective of, you know, everybody has a choice to drive how they want and to react how they want, and I don't know what kind of day they've had. I don't know what kind of experience they've had. All I know is the kind of experience I have. And so for me, that was my way of live and let live type thing without getting angry. And I was introduced to this information just like this past summer. The next time you're in an argument or a fight with, you know, a friend or a loved one or, well, anyone, what normally happens when you get in an argument, you basically, your brain clicks into, you know, that mode where it wants to, I'm going to hurt you emotionally and mentally so that I can win the war, the argument, the battle. And a lot of times people say you can never take back words that are spoken, and words can be extremely hurtful. If both people are in that mindset when they're having an argument, of I'm going to hurt you as much as I can so I can win. If one person in that whole argument is able to change their thoughts to what they love about the other person while they're yelling and screaming at them. And I know it's kind of like, well, that's kind of difficult to do. Like, it's kind of impossible because we're trained to react, you know, violence with violence and anger with anger instead of, you know, if people are yelling at us, react with love. But if you're able to really get in touch with those feelings of, you know, the good parts and the wonderful things that that person, you know, exhibit, not at the moment, obviously, then it's almost impossible for you to get angry, and your words and your thoughts and your actions are going to be completely different. And then the other person, in general, not in every specific case, obviously, is going to start realizing they're not getting angry. How can I win if they don't get angry?
Well, yeah. Well, that's what it's all about. It's about the winning.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't think it's all about that. Let me rephrase that. It's not all about winning. It's the source of the arguments, like what you're talking about, like with in a relationship,
mm-hmm.
where two couples are really trying to drive their point home. And it doesn't matter what it's escalated into. If it's escalated into, you know, yelling at somebody, or if it's escalated into an actual brawl, whatever it is, you're still hurling, you know, this angry energy at the other person.
Oh, yeah.
But the source of it, to me, it seems to be that you are in a place of extreme loneliness. When anger starts, you're lonely. I'll put a finer point on it for you.
Yeah, explain that a little bit more for me.
The reason people are arguing is because someone has done an infraction against another person. And then the other person has responded in whatever way. And there's a myriad of ways. Some people are passive aggressive. Some people get angry out of the gate. Some people blame, whatever it is. And they put their point across of how they felt as a result. And if the person starts defending what they've done, even if it is absolutely rational, the person who was slighted is all of a sudden feeling like that other person did not empathize with the way they felt.
Yeah.
And they get angry. And the anger is that that person is not empathizing with them. This person isn't taking the time to understand how they felt. And even if what they did was wrong, to them, everybody's feelings are absolutely valid at the moment they're feeling them.
Oh, yeah.
They are. They're valid right there, no matter what the feeling is. And that's why I say that whatever you're feeling, you know, don't beat yourself up for how you feel, because it's valid. You know, it's valid because it's a reflection of who you are. You know,
mm-hmm.
maybe you'll feel those feelings less if you change who you are through experience. But at that time, there's something valuable to be learned from that feeling, or to be acknowledged about who you are.
Mm-hmm.
Let me distill it down with an example.
Okay.
Jackie and I, we are the worst fighters in the world. We don't fight well. We can't. We're terrible at it. You know, I mean, people really say, that's a fight? That's pathetic. We never do. And then when we do, it's like, you know what? I should have. You know? And it's really sad. But one example is our dogs are a combined weight of 14 pounds. Seriously, one's 8 pounds, one's 5 pounds. They're really tiny. They're really small, and they like to run if they get outside on a leash.
Uh-huh.
My father-in-law held the door open. One of the dogs took off, and all of a sudden, every single fear, here we are, fears,
uh-huh.
is a result of my fears. I'm always afraid that the dogs are going to not get seen because they're so small, and they're going to get hit by a car.
Yeah.
So my fear of their safety fueled my anxiety.
But wasn't that fear out of love?
Well, yes, it was fear out of love, but it was a distorted fear.
Okay.
It was a distorted fear. It's just my fear that that's what's going to happen. I mean, my choices did not become rational at that point because, forgive me for protracting this example out a little bit. If this dog sensed that you're anxious,
mm-hmm.
she's going to keep running from you.
Oh.
You're projecting this really anxious energy, and she's like, I don't want to have anything to do with it. But if you're cheering, you're calm, and you're happy, and you're upbeat, you can get her to come back to you.
Hmm.
My fear short-circuited the logic behind that, and I started to go into high energy mode. And Jackie was like, you know what? Your high energy is not going to help the situation, right? I was already in fear mode. I was already in anxious mode. So then the rest of the emotions were already haywired and crazy making was commencing. And I was getting annoyed because she didn't understand that I was concerned for this dog's safety. And she had not empathized with the fact that I care and love these dogs. There you go. Your connection to the love. So I love these dogs. She didn't understand that my reaction was valid because I love the dogs, and it was out of love that that was happening. Again, I'm affirming your point. But the thing about it is, after the heat settled down, she's like, oh, you know what? I'm sorry for not taking that into consideration, that you were legitimately upset. And I'm like, you know what? I'm sorry that I reacted the way I did because I didn't need to. And she's like, well, you know, these dogs get, you know, they don't respond well to that. And I knew she was right. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
But for me, it's easy enough. You know, I don't need to be right. I'm not one of those people. I just don't. You know, I put on my Facebook little profile, I have being right is overrated. It really is. And when you hold on to being right, it's because you need that to validate yourself because you feel so invalidated so often. That seems to be the pattern with people who will go to the ends of the earth to be right. And they will not back down, even when they look silly. They'll find a way to be right because it's so desperate. They're so afraid of being wrong that it is going to compromise their self-worth.
And to me, that's inability to open up to the love and support. But most people have, you know, from like friends and family and even, you know, even coworkers, depending on the job that you work in. You know, if you're feeling more and more secluded and you're less supported and you don't have, you know, somebody there that you feel like you're receiving some kind of love from, then I can see what you're talking about spiraling down further and further and further to where, you know, it becomes a very cold and dark place.
Can I ask you a question on that point?
Sure.
Do you need that love from other people in order to have self-love?
I see your point. I think that ideally, your own self-love should be able to be all that you need. But at the same time, biologically and socially, I believe that we as human beings are set up to have interactions with other people to support one another. And so in a physical body, while we're still alive, I think that it's extremely detrimental to somebody who does not have any kind of support or compassion or any signs of love from somebody else.
So you do believe that it's kind of a reinforcement? It's like a feedback of some sort?
I think that the more support that you have, the more love you can express. It's kind of like if... Okay. I'm not sure if you've heard about this experiment, and I can't remember the name of people who did it, but I think it was back in the 70s or 80s, even possibly the 80s, where they took these baby rhesus monkeys. You know, they had a control group where they kept them secluded in a way and didn't allow them to, you know, hold on to have any kind of physical contact with their mother, and then they had one that where they were able to have physical contact with a, you know, some
like a
kind
simulacrum
of,
kind
yeah,
of
a simulated mannequin with the carpet on and whatever,
right.
And little heater underneath, and then of course they had the group that, you know, was normal. What they found out is that as these baby monkeys grew up, the ones that didn't have any kind of physical contact were much easier to be manipulated, much quicker to anger. They were much more reactionary. They didn't have as much control over their emotions as you would think. And then the ones that even had the mannequin with the carpet over it, the fake touch and everything, they still did fairly well. And compared to the ones that had the normal, you know, live physical contact. And what they came up with is that it is extremely to the benefit for human beings to have to have physical contact with one another, especially when in the first few years of our life. And so taking that to a further degree, I think if you are removed completely from human contact for years and years at a time, I think it becomes very difficult to maintain self-love unless you're able to find something in you. Like, Tom Hanks in the movie Castaway. Mm-hmm. You know, he was on an island for, I think, what was it, 2-3 years? There was that point where he was just like, I give up. And they didn't make a big deal about it in the movie. They mentioned it, but they didn't make a big deal about it. And then all of a sudden he's like, well, my survival mode has kicked in and I can't kill myself, so what am I going to do now? Well, I need to have something. And, you know, the plane that he was on was a FedEx plane that had crashed, and he found a soccer ball and, you know, created a face on it and named it Wilson after, you know, because that was the name on it already. Mm-hmm. And had this kind of like alter ego patterned onto this inanimate object just to have some sort of sense of company, of some sort of relationship, even though it was all in his head. Mm-hmm. Some people are perfectly fine being hermits. Most people that I'm aware of for the general population need some sort of human interaction, some kind of human contact, some kind of, you know, physical, mental, emotional, you know, showing of, hey, you, I love you, you know, right. to feel good, to have a sense of happiness and joy that then can, you know, create their sense of self-love even stronger that they're able to present back to other people.
Well, it sounds to me what you're talking about is the idea of the reflective property of other people outside yourself.
Well, yeah, because we're all connected, right?
Right. That everybody that you meet, without exception, and I believe this irrefutably, that everybody you meet outside yourself is a reflection of yourself in some way, shape, or form or another.
Hmm.
I mean, do you subscribe to that idea?
That's one I'm still working on, because the implications of every person that you meet, are you talking about in person? Are you talking about through correspondence from books? I mean...
Oh, I don't care. I'm going to use this across the board without exception.
Okay, so that would mean that anytime you are introduced to another person, another person's work, or another person's thoughts, that there is something with that person that is a reflection of you. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. See, and I have difficulty with that, and I don't have a definite yes or definite no whether I agree with that or not.
What's the part you have trouble with?
Because the thing is, assuming that we're all connected, then we're all expressions of the same, you know, divinity.
Right.
But we are all individuals having a spiritual experience while we're alive. To say that a reflection of somebody else that we're introduced to is a reflection of, you know, something within us, then I can't go that far. I just don't see it, because, I mean, you walk by a newscast in the airport or in the store, and or all of a sudden you're hearing about this person that, you know, shot up 3 people in this apartment in, you know, 3 miles away, and saying that that person is a reflection of some part of you.
See, now I think this is where that idea gets misunderstood.
Okay.
Because a lot of people say, you know, yeah.
Break it down for me, Dave.
Break it down. There are people who say, you know what, that guy is, you know, he's really obnoxious. This is a really obnoxious person, and he's kind of brash, and he speaks before thinking. And I'm a person who weighs my words very carefully. To say that guy is a reflection of me when I'm nothing like him doesn't make any sense. That's a misinterpretation of what I think the reflected property is. The reflected property is that, based on your reaction to another individual, says something about yourself. In other words, you...
Oh, okay, you see the what reaction. I'm saying? I missed the word reaction.
Well, it's still a reflective property. In other words, it's a reflection of a way you see yourself. Okay, we'll take the guy who speaks his mind. The guy who what's the term they use when somebody doesn't editorialize themselves? They don't screen what they say.
Oh yeah, no filter.
You know what I'm talking about? Yeah, the no filter people. They just speak without a filter. And then you take the guy who says, you know what, that just drives me crazy that he does this. Because you know what? I weigh my words very carefully.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm saying is that it is the fact that this person aggravates the other person. Demeanor in that person aggravates the other person. So it is reflecting an aspect of that of themselves that they don't care for. Not that same thing, but it's resonating with a part of themselves that they're not comfortable with. And I could chase it down the rabbit hole. I mean, it could easily be the fact that why does this person weigh their words so carefully? Do they weigh their words so carefully because they don't want to be misunderstood and they don't want to be thought like a louse or loudmouth and all that other stuff? This person can do this without liberty and, you know, with liberty and without, you know, any restraint. Mm-hmm. Yet they're the ones who have to do this. And that person that can be unfiltered can get away with saying whatever they want without any repercussions. But this other person's working so hard to filter their words. It just doesn't seem fair.
Oh, I mean, so you see what I'm saying? Fairness in life.
Well, no. What I'm saying is it something in their self-worth? I mean, we talked about anger, right?
Yeah.
The anger is that short-circuitness, that kind of lack of self-love. So if this person's angry about that other person who doesn't editorialize themselves, what about themselves does it speak to that they don't have a love for themselves with?
Well, to me, right offhand, it would be they wish that they were able to be that open and free with their words.
Sure. I would go with that. I mean, this isn't a blanket statement that can apply to everybody. Yeah. But in this scenario, it could apply, we could say.
Yeah. But the thing is, then, with my example, you know, walking through like a department store or even, you know, they have news channels on everywhere now in bars and airports and, you know, everywhere you go. And so you walk into a place that has one of these TV news channels on and all of a sudden you hear about, you know, this grisly murder that happened. You feel one way or another about it, and you're like, oh man, that is just, you know, gives you the creeps and everything, you know, or you're like, oh, well, they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. Are you saying that that also reflects back onto who you are with your reaction to that? In other words, if you have that kind of like, oh, people were in the wrong place at the wrong time, then would you say that that person is, you know, less caring and less compassionate than the person that's like, oh man, that was terrible. Oh my goodness.
Well, you know, these are really tough examples to use mm-hmm. because they're hypotheticals.
Oh, I know.
But in the case, you're talking about a person who seems to be disconnected from the compassion towards other people, right?
Yeah.
Because they don't seem to react. That's a possibility. And that could reflect on, you know, that maybe they're just disconnected with their own humanity. Maybe that they just feel like they're marching through lives themselves. And, you know, I mean, have you ever known really joyful people to really be that dispassionate about something that happens tragically to another person?
Not joyful people. It's normally the people that are, you know, down in the dumps and not feeling as positive as, you know, other people. You know, it's kind of like misery loves company. It's like when the mountains of life are coming down upon you, you start seeing tragedy everywhere.
Well, that or you're looking for it.
Exactly. But the thing is, that goes back to the law of attraction that we've talked about in that episode of the law of attraction where we were introduced to Fred McMulderberry.
Yeah.
You know, it's partly that you're more aware of it, your perception is more open to it, but if you are constantly feeling in a negative way, then you're attracting more and more negativity to you and more reasons to feel, you know, less positive. Oh, well, that's kind of an interesting idea I just had. So if you are able to live in a more positive way, then following with the law of attraction, you'll start bringing more experiences and witnessing and observing more and more things that are more positive that reinforce what you would like to see, and therefore that could help you, create more of a sense of love for your fellow man instead of, oh, the world's going to crap anyway, and hopefully it won't
just
bother
what you
me.
Said. Well, yeah. I mean, because you can't really avoid negative news, that kind of news, tragic events.
Oh, but you can.
It's really difficult. I mean, you can. I hear it. I do hear tragic things happening. I don't watch the news, and I don't read the newspapers, and I don't read online news media. I just don't, because they don't offer anything that's uplifting to my spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And I do read things that are uplifting to my spirit. I'm very attracted to those things. But when I do come across something that is a tragic event, the way I see it is I have compassion for the victims, and I also have compassion for the perpetrator.
Oh, yeah.
When you do feel positive and fulfilled, you can have compassion, because if you're in a really dark place, it's really easy to look at the person who convicted that crime and say, hang him, hang him, you know, with your torch out and the pitchforks and all that other stuff.
Yeah.
Because we want justice, dang it. We want justice.
Civilized revenge as well.
Civilized revenge. I mean, pardon the segue, but I had a conversation with a guy. I don't think I've ever shared this on the podcast. If I have, tell me.
Okay.
I have trouble with the idea of justice because it doesn't seem like it's truly just. I did talk in an episode about the woman whose son was murdered by another young man.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I don't care if he finds a cure for cancer, I will never forgive him.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, I have no idea what episode that was.
I don't either. I don't either. But that, to me, it's not justice. It's justice if you did a horrendous act, and then through having done that horrendous act, you can save the lives and change for the better lives of many, many people after that.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, what I'm saying is it is just if that person's life wasn't lost in vain.
Yeah.
Then their lesson came from it. And if we go to the past life idea, you know, there may be a contractual obligation where this person offered themselves up for that life lesson for that person, if we want to go there. But to punish someone, you know, just because they did a crime, because you want to see them pay, does that ever really bring you true joy? Is true joy when somebody else suffers, or when somebody else feels hurt and you feel joy of that, is that really true joy?
And the thing is, I don't think it is. I mean,
nor do I.
Okay, I believe Texas still has the death penalty.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you bet they do.
And being technically born in Texas, you know, I am officially a Texan, but we moved out of Texas when I think I was like 8 months old or something like that. And
that's because they didn't want you to end up on death row as an 8 month old, because they'd do it there. No, I kid, Texas.
Yeah, I know. But the thing is, that goes back to that whole reactionary. And it comes to the point where what I mentioned earlier with these highly spiritual people like the Dalai Lama and Mother Teresa and, you know, Mahatma Gandhi. Would they be out there saying, oh, he's a serial killer, he killed 25 people in 2 years, and not only did he do that, he did him really grisly, like, hang him, let him fry. I don't think you'd see them out there. And I mean, that brings up the question as, why would they not be out there? And to me, it's because they're filled with so much compassion and so much love for the other person, regardless of who they are and regardless of what they've done.
Yes.
That it doesn't matter what they've done. Now, you know, for me personally, it'd be like, okay, you did the crime, we have to save the rest of the community and from your inclinations and whatnot.
Right.
So we're going to put you in prison, but we don't have to give, you know, put you to death, unless,
right,
because unless of course it came down to a point where all of a sudden this person found a way to start murdering inmates, and there was very little other option of, okay, we don't know where to put you, can't have you in the community, can't have you in the prison, can't have you we don't have a, you know, deserted island that we could put you on. We just have nowhere to put you, and you're a danger to yourself and other people. You know, under those circumstances, I would be a little and I'm saying this just a little bit more open to the death penalty, unless if all other possibilities were exhausted. I mean, I think that would be like maybe 0.001% of, you know, the whole population of people that commit crimes, whereas majority of people, you know, commit crimes. It's like, okay, yeah, they're still people. Mm-hmm. They're still, you know, human beings.
Exactly.
And if you have love in your heart, then you have love for everything that you're surrounded by. That's animals, plants, other people, and even people that do terrible things. It's like, I'm not a parent, but I, you know, if you're a parent and your child does something really, really just, there are parents that they interview that had their children murdered by serial killers. Mm-hmm. Some of them say, you know what? I'm glad justice has been done. Mm-hmm. Not referring that they're going to get the death penalty, but at the same time, they're saying, I pray for their soul. And it's kind of like, well, wait a second. If you're praying for their soul, then you're trying to change them. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, are you being selfish in that respect, trying to make everybody more like you? Or is that an actual sign of compassion where it's just like, look, my religious beliefs say that I am to forgive, and even though I suffered a great loss due to your hand, I'm able to forgive you. I'll never forget, but I can forgive.
Right. Yeah. That is compassion to me, because that means to me that that person doesn't want the perpetrator to suffer. Right. I mean, because it's like, to me, I know what suffering is like, and I wouldn't want to wish that on anybody else, even people that might have done a crime against me, you know, because I do believe that people who wish suffering upon their perpetrators want the perpetrator to feel what they're feeling.
Yeah.
But I do believe that suffering is often a choice. And you know, the thing is like, when you have compassion, it really does heal. You know, I'm going to use that word liberally. I'm not a big fan of the word. I know it's what you do, and so forgive me on that. But
no worries.
I think it's a, I think we talked about it in the healing episode. But anyway, mm-hmm. Gary Ridgway, you know who he is, right? The Green River Killer.
Oh yeah, okay.
For listeners who are not familiar with it, here in Washington State, we have a man known as the Green River Killer who murdered dozens of people. He's pretty high profile, and so a lot of people have probably heard of him. And I don't know why, what's with our state that we get all the serial killers, but we do. Ted Bundy, Green River Killer. Nonetheless, the loved ones of the victims that he had taken their lives were screaming and calling him names and wished him all this other stuff, and he just sat there just stoically. Mm-hmm. But there was one person that said, you know what, I'm hurting, and I'm deeply hurting, and I'm really sad for the loss of the person that, you know, I loved, but I forgive you, and I hope you find peace. And that was the only time that you saw Ridgway break down physically. He was emotionally wrought, and he was just crying. And I'm like, do monsters cry? You know, I mean, why would he cry at that statement and not the others if he was supposedly faking it? Because there's people who won't give him a break on anything. He killed people. That's it. There's that humanity in him that moved him, that a person could show him compassion. Because for him to take life after life after life, I personally believe he has no sense of love for himself.
Oh, yeah.
I think the people who can easily take lives like that do not have any self-love. They're bereft of self-love. So when somebody else shows them that kind of love, it touches that little teeny tiny light that's barely smoldering in them, that they were actually worthy of that love. And it moved them to tears that how could someone be worthy of me when I have no love for myself or anyone around me because of the reflective property, mm-hmm. yet someone did have love for himself.
Like the Grinch and the Grinch Who Stole Christmas.
Like the Grinch and the Grinch Who Stole Christmas. It's a beautiful parody for that. Or not parody, it's not. Yeah. I mean, parable, excuse me.
Oh, yeah. And the thing is, probably the reason why when people are yelling and cursing at him and saying, you know, how horrible a person he is like, well, I don't feel good about myself, so you're just telling me what I already know. You're preaching to the choir. Keep it coming.
Exactly.
And then all of a sudden somebody says something that's completely unexpected, and it's just like, whoa, 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 whoa. You know, I can just imagine what was going through his mind. He was just like, I'm a bad person. Everybody tells me I'm a bad person. I tell myself I'm a bad person. You're telling me I'm not? Mm-hmm. Not even that I'm not a bad person, or that I'm still worthy of forgiveness?
Right. Have you ever been able to punish someone into love?
Yeah.
You know, it's like there's that old satirical statement, beatings will continue until morale improves. You know, to me, that's our justice system operates that way. And like, I agree with you. We do need to sequester people so they don't cause continued harm to other people if they have a propensity to do so. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, that doesn't mean, you know, you throw out any potential compassion for them as well. I mean, love is very healing. The people who, in quotes, deserve it the least are the ones who need it the most.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. So what would be some of your final thoughts on love?
I do believe that when we really connect to our love of self, and I don't mean that in a hedonistic or arrogant way, but really to just know that we are beautiful creatures in and out for all our faults, and we love our faults, our own faults, mm-hmm. then we can love the faults of everyone else.
Oh, that's beautiful. I have to go with the same thing, where it's just like, the more love that you're able to find in the world, the more easier you're able to express, you know, the love that you have to the world. When under those circumstances, the more people that are able to find more and more love in the world and express that love more and more to everyone else, the more loving of a world we'll have. Mm-hmm. To me, I think that it would be just, you know, absolutely beautiful.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So visit our main page at TakeTheRedPillPodcast.com, where you'll find links to David's blog and my business website. And also, if this is your first episode that you've heard from us, we'd like to welcome you. If you're a longtime listener, we'd like to thank you for your continued listening to these podcasts from David and I. So, for TakeTheRedPillPodcast.com, I am Donald Dalton, wishing you to love, love, love.
And I'm David Deere. Be love.